The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's Ihsan Higgins here with the Legal Hour, and a very warm welcome to the listeners, and thank you for tuning into the Voice of the Cape. Tonight we're talking about community protests in the face of police violence. We've seen quite a bit of violence lately, you know, on TV, you know, with regard to, I mean, if I refer now to places like Bonteville, Menenberg, and places like Bukup specifically in the last week. And we want to examine tonight, you know, some of the legal implications and or the legality of the violence that's currently, that we got caught up in the as a community by certain officials. Let's call them South African police or city police. In fact, we're going to examine, you know, who's responsible for these things, right up to the political level. And in what possibly, we've got the lawyers here tonight, we've got social activists here tonight, and we're going to look at some of the issues and the implications pertaining to this violence against our very, very peaceful communities, or generally peaceful communities. So in studio with me tonight, I've got Nazir Parker, who's no stranger to the Legal Hour. Assalamu alaikum, Nazir.
Wa alaikum salam, Ihsan, and to the rest of the listeners.
Okay, and Nazir is going to, you know, speak to us on some of the technical aspects of the violence against our communities. And then we got also no stranger to the Legal Hour, we got Shyam Samai. Assalamu alaikum, Shyam.
Assalamu alaikum to all the listeners.
And Shyam is still furiously typing some SMS or email that she needs to type out. But thanks for being here, Shyam. I know you are a very, very busy activist and attorney. And Shyam is also going to talk us through some of the issues that, you know, that the Bukup community faces itself with, and give a commentary on it. Then we got a very special guest here also. We got none other than Anwar Nagia. Assalamu alaikum, Anwar.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Ihsan, and to Shyam and Nazir.
Anwar is absolutely no stranger to this program or to this radio or any other radio in the world. In fact, we're going to have to take a leave of absence of Anwar because I believe you need to be interviewed again at 8 o'clock by which radio station?
Islam Media.
Okay, by Islam Media. Also on some of these issues, you know, affecting our community at this point. So, Shyam, would you like to just contextualize, you know, the violence that we experienced in Bukup? And I'm not going to go yet to the other issues of Bonteville and all those other places, but just give us a little bit of a context. Why, in fact, the police were called in? Just a little bit of a background.
Yes, Ihsan, I think it's important. I'm also just, as you know, part of the Bukup community, and we formed a broader network of professionals, which we are calling out, you know, to give support to the civic, which is the Bukup Collective. And so there's a few lawyers of us that is part of this Bukup Collective, and we have tried to look at and analyze what actually happened on that Tuesday. But just in a nutshell is that there was an application for an interdict to stop people from obstructing the activities of the developer. So it was a very broad interdict that was given against the Bukup Neighborhood Watch, as well as a particular individual, and then broadly a third respondent, which is all of these people, which is, like I said, exceptionally broad. But it was also against the SAPS,
South African Police,
as well as the Metro, which the interdict is saying that they must give the developer support in relation to ensuring that these activities can be done. Now, the issue here is that a lot of people have different opinions and a lot of things to say around
Shyam, just before you, let's talk a little bit about this interdict. Okay, so this particular applicant in court decided they're going to interdict the community from what? From doing what?
Obstructing activities.
Okay.
In particularly around the development.
Okay.
And then also this crane. And I think that that was just the interdict. And therefore, when the protests happened, now these protests have been occurring for some time now. It is, and this protest is in different areas. It's primarily in Whale Street, which happens every day from 5 to 6. And then it moves also to different areas, which includes the block site. So that is people actually just objecting to the particular development. Shyam, and they've got a right to do that.
Shyam, is there a precedent for this anywhere in South Africa where people actually, I mean, where a community where has been interdicted for certain conduct, a whole community, even those that can't read or write?
No, I mean, there hasn't been. I mean, not that we have, I have seen, in particular, I haven't seen an interdict like
this. Okay, now just give me a second, Anwar. Have you ever seen something like this, a whole community being interdicted from doing something, from not obstructing a certain, let's call a measure of conduct, like bringing up a crane into Bukap?
Yeah, I've never seen this, Ihsan, and it's... when I comment later, it's really an overreach, A, by the court, and B, the unfettered access the developers have to be able to command the quasi-state structures like the City of Cape Town and their municipal police services to go in their numbers with paramilitary-style fashion to block communities.
I want to start off maybe just with the court process. Let's not get...
Well, I just think it's an overreach, complete overreach, and there's no precedent that I know of in South Africa where a whole community has been...
Have you seen something like this in your entire career?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head, Ihsan, where our order is so... I would say vast in its effect, whereby it can basically impact not one or two, but literally hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, and in order to I mean, of course, the community has a right to oppose this thing. And I mean, it's very simple to say, you know what, the community can oppose it if they're not happy. But what does an interdict cost? I mean, what does it cost to oppose an interdict of this nature? Nazir? More or less, so you don't have to give me an exact figure, but you obviously need to appoint an attorney, you need to appoint an advocate, and what does all this cost?
Ihsan, High Court interdict opposing it, you're looking at a minimum cost of at least about 25,000.
Sorry?
A minimum of 25,000 upwards.
How much?
25.
Okay, so it's a lot of money. Shyam, can our community up in Bukap and in the flats afford these things?
Of course not. I mean, that is one. I mean, we need to acknowledge, I mean, Bukap in itself is a working class community.
Mm-hmm.
And that has always been the challenge that I had with most of, you know, opposing these developments, is that we don't have the technical support, I would say. There's a lot of goodwill, there's a lot of, people that want to oppose. But the challenge is that, you know, to even appoint an attorney costs money. And, you know, you need to, you get assistance from people on a pro bono basis, or they have to go to the NGOs,
mm-hmm.
which is organizations like myself, like or other organizations. And there's only a few of us around that will be able to do or assist with these type of submissions.
No, it costs money. Yeah, we're very aware. But I mean, of course, every time a developer brings an application or interdict against the community, it costs the community money which... It seems they don't have. Anwar, what is your just take? Because we're going to break now for ads.
Ihsan, just very simply.
Just give me a quick rundown of that.
Access to justice is very expensive. And in the post-apartheid period, it's an indictment, in fact, on the state to be able to not give communities their right to have access to justice. So the 25,000 is the bare minimum. We know that a minimum for council and opposing council, and if you lose this matter, it could cost you 100,000 rand. It means that the community is exhausted. So they try to tire the community with these modern techniques of access to justice where funding is concerned. That's the one aspect.
And when we come back, I want to ask you, why is the court so eager to give these types of interdicts against whole communities? I mean, I would like to examine this afterwards, and I would like to hear Nazir and Shyam's response. We're going to break for an ad now. When we come back, we're going to look at those issues.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
Assalamu alaikum, and we are back with the Legal Hour, and with me is Nazir Parker, Sham Samai, and Anwar Nagia, and we're talking about the protests in our various areas, and of course the conduct of the police and or the city police in these the proceedings. Now, before we go anyway, Nazir, can you give me the definition of SAPS, South African Police, and then of course the city police, and then of course security personnel, and I mean all these types of things, because I think all these members, let's call them members for now, the public has been confused a bit. In fact, they call all of these people police. And of course, when one looks at the uniforms that they're wearing, it's obviously different uniforms. Mm. Now, just give me a little bit of a rundown as to who's who in the zoo there.
Ikshan, if I just look at the as you termed it now, the police. The police in its broadest scope is the South African Police Service. They are the national police, and they are brought about through the South African Police Services Act. And they are responsible for combating crime on a national level. Now, when we say on a national level, we talk about anything related to crimes canvassed in the Criminal Procedure Act, murder, rape, robbery, very limited traffic offenses like reckless and negligent driving, things like that is why the national police is there. And they are, like I said, brought about through the South African Police Services Act. And then you have your local municipal law enforcement guys.
Is this what we call the city police?
This is what you call the city police, or as the Criminal Procedure Act refers to them as peace officers. And in Cape Town specifically, we've got three divisions of the peace officers. You have the law enforcement guys, you have the metro police, and then you also have I had it now here in front of me.
Okay, now Nazir, okay, while you're looking for that, so there's three categories.
Yeah.
So, law enforcement officers, what are those?
Law enforcement.
And how do they look?
Well, they've actually, as you quite correctly said, they're all dressed differently to one another, albeit that they're all the city police basically has a similar type of dress code. But the law enforcement, they are identified and kitted out in their blue uniforms, the navy blue, with sometimes they have khaki pants on.
Who do they report to?
They, all three of them, report to the city of Cape Town.
Not to the province?
Not to the province.
Not to the national commissioner?
Not the national commissioner. They report to the city of Cape Town. They are locally...
So we could call them the police force of the city?
That's correct, indeed.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
The other division was the traffic services. That was the one I didn't...
So there's three. So it's law enforcement, there's the metro police, and then there's the traffic.
That's correct.
Okay. So what's the duties of what we call law enforcement?
Law enforcement, effectively, Sean, is there to uphold the bylaws of the city of Cape Town.
Okay.
When we say bylaws, there's specific references made to graffiti control, nuisance complaint, public intoxication. There's also a specific division dealing with cable theft within the city. So the law enforcement basically will be there to protect the greater public against these type of, call it Schedule 1 offences.
Okay, now the Metro Police, who are they?
Metro Police, similarly also under the banner of the city of Cape Town, and they are also identified through khaki trousers and beige shirts, and they provide critical support for the South African Police Services in implementing their duties under the national banner. But they, like I said, they are easily identified, different to national police. National police across the country wears the same uniform, drives the same vehicles. The other three, call it splinter forces, operate completely independent of the South African police and look distinctly different as well. Sometimes the Metro Police does overlap in terms of the duties and how they carry out their duties. Sometimes they will go further than what they are guided to or enforced to do.
And what about jurisdiction? I mean, who in other words, let's say they get to a protest action. Under whose jurisdiction does the law and order part of the protest fall?
the law and order part under protest would fall under the city of Cape Town, or the municipality itself dealing, not now specifically limiting it to the city of Cape Town, but with the municipality dealing with that specific protest application, call it that.
Okay, so the SAPS, another, the National Police, where do they fall in this whole thing?
Well, the National Police, in a scenario like you are discussing, would be more playing a more supportive role. And one has to take into consideration that Metro Police, law enforcement, traffic, they're all limited in terms of their numbers, their ability to carry out certain duties. And that is why sometimes the local municipality would involve the services of the National Police to assist in carrying out the, call it, overseeing the protest.
Okay, Shyam. Shyam, thank you. who was actually the... let's call it, was the protection officers or the enforcement officers at the Buka protest on Tuesday? Was it SAPS? Was it city police? Was it enforcement?
It was all of them. SAPS was there, and then what we call the POP units, which is the public order policing, was there. They are normally, they are unit from SAPS.
SAPS.
And
okay.
They normally, I think some time ago we spoke about the different units within SAPS. So you have like the visible policing, you have like the POP units, and everybody has different badges. So your POP units will normally have the red badges.
Okay, Shyam, we're going to talk a little, I'm just a bit concerned that we're going to break for Maghrib in about 4 minutes, but Anwar, your comment on...
Isan, just very simply,
okay.
just to call a spade a spade. There is no ways, as first of all, private security companies can police public open space and can police the public. So that is already wrong. So we must prepare an application to say that they acted completely in an unlawful manner.
The security companies.
They cannot be on the roads.
And they
cannot
be in the streets.
And they
accountable to who?
They're accountable to their own private persons who can protect their property. They must be 1 meter or 2 meters at their property. They cannot be in the streets. They cannot direct the police. They cannot be part of the police services. That's number one. So that already is wrong. So we can bring charges against each of those particular individuals because they are private. South African law does not allow private armies, in fact, to interfere with state issues. Number two, the municipal police have limited powers only to direct the public against city council's property, land invasions, issues of the state buildings, issues of the municipal buildings in the roads. That is the municipal police with the khaki uniforms in the old, and the old out was for hulle geroep soldaatjies sonder plaatjies, because there was kits constables at the time. They got quick training to do law enforcement. They can look at the trains, they can look at violence and cables. They cannot, in fact, be deployed against the public. The South African police services, you know, here we believe when the city of Cape Town is in problems, they then says police is a national competency. They then say the police is being neglected by the Minister of Police to actually put gang units in Cape Town. I'm just giving an example.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the city can use their contacts in the police to absolutely manhandle the public. How was it possible for the city of Cape Town and the province to release people to protect private property in the streets? The public was nowhere near the private property. The public was down at the bottom in Whale Street, protecting the area from being completely cannibalized and brutalized in terms of the whole gentrification project. But they were on state's property. They were not on the private property. So therefore, that police could not do what they did do, because they were not.
Were you
the
referring
public.
To now? Well, there's of
there's
course
three,
there's
no,
SAPS,
three.
There's enforcement, well, and then of course the Metro Police.
Well, so the Metro Police acted ultra vires. The SAPS acted in an overzealous manner in terms of protecting people from stopping trucks and of course equipment coming through the area. And then thirdly, the private armies that was deployed there with a paramilitary uniform and psychological warfare in terms of their dress code, in terms of their batonry and their armor, was to browbeat 80-year-olds and people. So that we must look. We still got time to bring that particular person's, not only through IPED, but to court.
But I'm going to ask Shyam a question quickly. Shyam?
Yes.
Please, I can't ask questions if you're playing with your phone.
But yeah. Ihsan, one of the things, you know what I'm actually reading, is okay. that Advocate Donan wrote a very
good article,
that is the article that I think we need to discuss.
Exactly. Yeah, but before we discuss it, let me just ask you about, because we don't have a lot of time if we're going to break for Maghrib, the ATL. That there was no, was the ATL
no, there was no
everybody's talking
no.
about it.
What happened was that she was sitting in front when the protests happened. So when the first, when they were all sitting in front, and so when the police moved forward, they were all standing there. But who they took was, they took a one of the women who was then placed in the car, and then they arrested two persons first. So there was a lot of altercation, a lot of things that were happening that moment, because they threw stun grenades. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of things that were happening and running around.
Okay, so there was no idea all the rest, just to put the record straight.
No, there were five people that were arrested, and I think we might make it clear that they were arrested in terms of the road traffic, which is to obstruct the road, and the second was contravention of this interdict. So those were the two charges, because I think it was extremely difficult to charge them in terms of the Gatherings Act, because the day before, the Constitutional Court just handed down a judgment in relation to Section 12 of the Gatherings Act, and they actually made it very clear around what the purpose of peaceful protests are, because people are sometimes confused between what is a violent process and those that is just a peaceful process. Because a protest in itself should be disruptive. You don't get protests just, you know, there's different levels of protests, but it doesn't mean a disruptive protest is a violent protest. And they had to actually look at whether or not the force of which they used against those people, whether or not it was actually proportionate to the protesting. And that's where the challenge comes in.
Nashyam, you're going to talk to us after Maghrib specifically about this Constitutional Court judgment in terms of protest, because I think it's very important that the community understand this particular judgment. Nazir, I would like you to obviously talk me through the whole concept of why they were not charged for public violence and why they jumped to traffic offense and to the breach of the interdict. In fact, Anwar, you were mentioning about this broad interdict situation. I cannot see how somebody can be charged with an interdict, for breaching an interdict, if you didn't read the interdict. I mean, as a non-lawyer, what is your understanding of that, before we break from our
I accept what you're saying, because many of the public themselves understood that the original interdict was against either the civic individuals that is obstructing the development taking place at that particular you know, if you call it St. Monica's or whatever.
Okay, Anwar, my technician, give me a fail taker. We are now having to break for Maghrib. I'm not sure if you're going to come back. Are you coming back after the walk? Maybe for about 5 minutes or so?
5 minutes. I need to just cover some other matter.
On that note, we're now going to break for Salah, and when we come back, we're going to continue with this program on protests and police action in respect thereof.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's Ihsan Higgins here again with the Legal Hour, and with me my guest is Nazir Parker, Shyam Samai, and Anwar Nagia. Unfortunately, Anwar will have to leave us in about 10 minutes from now, and Shyam will leave us in about 20 minutes from now, and Nazir will remain behind. So we're continuing now with our discussion pertaining to the protests by the communities and the subsequent violent reaction by members of the South African police and, of course, members of the, what did you say, Nazir? It was members of the The other groups?
Metro Police, law enforcement, and the traffic officials.
Yeah, the whole machinery of the state, the security apparatus, you know, for fighting against the community for whatever reason, and we're trying to unpack it. Anwar, seeing that you're going to be the first one to leave, maybe you just want to comment on, you know, certain of the nuances, you know, that comes through here. Because, you know, it's a very unusual situation for, number one, a court to give an interdict against the entire community, and then every single person of that community is deemed to have read that particular document, despite the fact that some people are not even able to read a normal letter, let alone a very complicated court document. And of course the subsequent reaction by the city and of course the national police.
Isan, first of all, let me just put something completely in context. This notion, when the court makes a pronouncement, it almost believes and it always says to us that that is the kind of moral judgment on the matter. Courts are not always right. Another court can find another decision by the judge who have erred. And we believe that, A, there's been an overreach of the law. I think that the whole process of gentrification persuaded the judge because he took the city's view, and even at the time Patricia Delol had the similar view of not declaring Boerkop a Schedule 1 heritage area and were in fact not pro-poor but was in fact pro-development and pro-gentrification. That's number one. Number two, my other observation is very simply that the police acted, certain of the police acted ultra vires. Are you the security polices?
Okay. Ultra vires, Nazir.
They acted beyond the scope of their powers.
I mean, I always just direct my panel. You
thanks,
know,
Nazir. Thanks. It's a Latin phrase in law, but it's fine. So A, we must take on review in the civic itself the actions by the private police that we must bring an application again. But we can leave that for now. We've got 3 months, we've got 4 months to do that. The municipal police were not protecting, should not have protected private property interests. The court didn't direct them to do that because we weren't near the property. And thirdly, the what they call paramilitary style police with stun grenades because nobody's lives was in danger. You only do that looting, rioting, and in fact bringing injury to public safety, and that was not the case. And so therefore, and of course the number of police and the high-handedness, that's the one aspect. I think we can reserve that right. But the other victory, I think, for the civic is that the people took to the streets almost in a way that they're now beginning to see that their heritage and their contribution over the many, many years in a stable community like Boerkop is under threat. And that certain of the people in Boerkop have lost their way to engage and to, in fact, go against the complete grain. I expected the Bruhanul meeting to be packed with people that was going to come there and almost challenge the status quo of the civic. And, you know, the maturity of the public rallied behind the civic, which must be commended. I commend the people for their bravery. I commend the persons that have got them all out of prison, Shiham, Ihsan, and all the guys who were actually involved in galvanizing, and the victory that they got because no charges was actually laid, the charges were dropped, because the police knew that they're on thin ice and on thin water. Lastly, that you can resolve this in two ways. One, at the ballot, we must be reminded that the local city and the local province, in fact, has not demonstrated a pro-poor policy and a heritage policy. They just have not done that. Forget you, I'm not asking you to vote for anybody else, but you cannot, in fact, endorse the same kind of behavior by your city officials who absolutely protected developers. We're going to have to take that interdict eventually under review to another court, and I believe another court will find justice if we believe in social justice. The people of Boerkop should be given precedent over these monstrosities and the violation of a stable community in terms of the process of gentrification. So if we don't watch it and we don't temper the spirit of some of the younger generation, which I don't necessarily believe that they are misdirected, I think they don't have institutional memory. and they can challenge me on it. That's fine. I don't think they have sufficient institutional memory, because the gentrification debate was 20 years. And if I look at that youngsters, they were 3 and 4 years old. But it doesn't mean that young generations don't have the will to give expression and to help us. They did in the beginning. I think they need to stand back and do an introspection and let us help them. We're not against them. But if they're going the route that they are going, if they have made deals with the developers quietly without involving other people, then that must be unpacked. They must come clean, and must come clean very quickly, because we cannot divide this community anymore.
Okay, Anwar, shukran for that. Shyam, maybe I just wanted to comment on it. And you know, I want to ask the question, and I mean, maybe it's a bit of an edgy question, is that, Anwar, are you leaving now? Because I know Anwar needs to be interviewed by another radio station. So Anwar, shukran very much for coming to assist, in this very, very difficult program. I think, it's always good to hear, the views of the old community activists. And I hope that, we're going to take this discussion a little bit further and maybe get some of those people, who has been mentioned on this program, because we always take things from a legal angle. And I mean, I'm very happy that you gave us some insight, even as a social activist, into, because I mean, you've got a lot of experience in this, in these types of things. So yeah, hopefully you can come back and, give us some more input.
The people of Bukhap don't have the monopoly on gentrification. The residents of Bukhap are not the only persons that can act as custodians of Bukhap. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the city of Cape Town must rally behind all areas, including Bukhap. So I'm not going to keep myself out of that area, and somebody's going to tell me I'm not a Bukhap resident and therefore I can't take up their struggle. That's nonsense. I'm not falling for that threat. I won't, I never have, and I never will. The issue of gentrification affects all of humanity and all of society in the post-apartheid period more so than ever. We are facing what is called a class struggle, not an anti-apartheid struggle. It's between the haves and the have-nots, and the defenseless have-nots. So we support everybody in Bukhap, and we support Tunadrang towards the youth. We're not against them. We can't be against. That's our future. But we want to shape it with them, and we want to tell them that if they lost their way, they must prove to us that they haven't lost their way. Thank you.
Okay, shukran Anwar for that words of wisdom. We're just going to go for a break, and we come back. I want to hear Shyam's take on the current, let's call it, division within the Bukhap community.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
And we are back with the Legal Hour. Anwar Nagia has left the studio, and we still have Nazir Parker, and we got Shyam Samai, and we're talking about the community action, the protest action, and subsequent police action, and some of it was indeed brutal. Shyam, my take on as a social commentator as well is that that when a community is faced with a crisis. In this instance, I would call this particular period or epoch in Bukhap a crisis. Isn't it prudent for this community to band together? I mean, I know that, from newspaper reports you hear there's one group and another group all commenting on, we've heard it on different media sources. Isn't this the time that the community needs to band together and, stand together? And come up with a collective strategy, or a legal strategy, against the onslaught against this community, whether it's in the form of violence by the police, whether it is the onslaught of gentrification. There's so many crises or points of crisis that this community faces. Isn't it imprudent for this community to actually just come together, set aside the differences, and identify the common threats?
Ifshan, I am going to agree with you 100%, but I need to just step back. This type of ADR,
okay, what
which
is ADR?
Is alternative dispute resolution,
yes,
is normally what happens when there is this level of conflict. But let me just say that this wasn't the first interdict that the developer brought. This was the second one. The first one was during June. And the challenge that we had there was that they then subsequently withdrew that. But before that, when the order was granted, the community actually defended themselves. They went to court on their own, and the court, which was, we believe it was Judge Henny, they gave a very creative order, and an order which he possibly acknowledged that the challenges had to be resolved. So he gave an order which actually said that the South African Human Rights Commission and our Sheikh Dawood had to mediate between the parties and come up with a solution and come back to court. Then a return
date. Was it done?
Well, before the Human Rights Commission started the process, there was even a whole engagement between the different parties. I'm talking about, you know, trying to set up how this is, was going to, the structure was going to actually deal with these, with the challenges. Sheikh Dawood was also involved. And then subsequently, the matter was withdrawn, which technically you and I know, once a matter is withdrawn, Then everything falls apart. Yes, exactly. Mm. Everything fell at that moment. Everything fell apart, which means that the Human Rights Commission couldn't do the court-ordered mediation or engagement. So here you had the court at that point in time, or at least the judge at that point in time, already acknowledged that there are lots of things that had to be done. Mm. Now we're talking about between July and now, right? A second interdict is brought.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, when we want to resolve this type of community conflict, it can only, what happens in a court is that the one party says one thing and the other party says another thing, and the court will obviously determine what the outcome is. It doesn't mean that the community, whoever else, might be happy with a particular outcome. But mediation or ADR, alternative dispute resolution,
I think,
is here.
Yeah, I think, Sham, just stick to the word mediation, because, of course, alternative dispute resolution could potentially mean arbitration. And
it can be arbitration. It can be conciliation.
Yeah, but we want to move away from the adjudication process. That's what I'm asking you. In terms of coming together, surely, you know, you have to have the different parties around the table.
Well, there has been a lot of people with broadly in the community that indicated that these things have to resolve, because everybody acknowledges at the end of the day, it is only the developers can win. It is the community at the end of the day suffers from the disunity, and we need to acknowledge that. And it's something that I agree with 100% that we need to be able to see how is it that we can amicably resolve this, and we need to be able to see how can we move forward. Now, the biggest challenge, obviously, is that the community in any form of mediation, and you know, you qualified mediator and arbitrator, that you need to agree to the terms, we need to agree to the parties, we need to agree with what the parameters are. And that is ultimately to ensure who is at the table. Because currently there's 150 people by the table. Mm-hmm. And let me explain that everybody has an opinion in relation to this matter. But ultimately it's the people that day that was there, that was affected, that was brutalized by SAPS. And so the Boka community...
I would actually caution you not to say by SAPS, because technically it wasn't just SAPS that was on the scene.
It was SAPS also the and Metro and yes. Traffic was also there.
Traffic
because
also.
That's another issue. People might think it's actually something which we haven't looked at.
Mm.
But the cars were actually given R1,000 traffic fines.
Is it? How many
yes.
cars?
There was a few cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where, that's the second altercation that happened. So there is lots of things that needs to be resolved.
Okay,
here.
Sham, my technician has given me the you know, the look, and we're just going to have to go for an ad break. When we come back, we're going to continue with the discussion. Nazir, please bear with us. I mean, Sham is not going to be here for long, and then I want you to take furious notes, because we're going to discuss a lot of these issues from a legal perspective after this.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
A And we are back with the Legal Hours. Ihsan Higgins here. I've still got with me in studio Nazir Parker and Shyam Samai, who's going to be leaving us shortly. Shyam, just a final word pertaining to the what you were speaking about a bit earlier on.
Yes, Ihsan, there was actually a very nice article that was done by Advocate Donan, where he actually uses the Boerkop community and the Protea Village community.
Was this the article in the Cape Times this
yes.
morning?
Okay. And it was about capitalism forcing communities out of city just like apartheid. And I think he does a very nice analogy because the Protea Village in Constantia, I think it's in the Bishop Court area, is obviously a restitution claim.
Yeah.
And Boerkop, he actually compares it. Whatever is happening in there is also a form of eviction, but it is developers driving residents out of the area. But one thing he says at the end, where he questions and he says, should the state be on the side of those with money or on the side of those who need it and help, who need to be helped and protected? And then he says that the answer is obviously it's obvious. But what happened in this particular matter is that can the court grant an order? Obviously, they can direct certain government departments, etc. But they directed SAPS to do a particular action and to support the developer. The question that we have is that, was that action correct? And secondly, could the court have done that? And thirdly, if the court did that, should SAPS or the police have opposed it? Because how is it possible that we can use state resources against a particular community?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the question that we have, is that one of the things that we need to look at in terms of the public order policing, it's not to escalate, it's to de-escalate violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
To de-escalate, mm-hmm. and to ensure that there is some form of resolve or peace that is being brought. How do you have so many police officers and metro police officers with private security company, with traffic, don't know where they ended up, actually, you know, forcing the community to at least move the community from that particular road. Something else had to happen. And what was the role actually of that unit? What was the role of
Are you talking about POPs now?
Of POPs.
Okay, now what's POPs again?
It's the public order policing.
Okay, so
and that is why when I spoke about the social justice, we call it the SJC 10, the SJC 10 matter, where section 12, where the court actually indicated that section 12, which dealt with where more than, you know, the provision, if it's more than 15 people, that the local municipality have to be given notice, otherwise
yeah,
they can be charged.
But is that relevant after this constitutional court judgment,
well,
surely?
Yes, but it's not about the relevance. It's that the constitutional court said that section 12.1 of the Gatherings Act was unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And the court, it upheld, obviously, a Western Cape High Court decision. But the court actually highlighted that the criminalization of citizens who are exercising their rights in terms of the constitution is a right which is afforded to them. And how can it be that at the end of the day they are being criminalized for actually exercising their particular right? So the case was brought by the Social Justice Coalition, and it was brought.
Shyam, what section of the Constitution gives you the right to protest? Surely there is.
Yes, there is freedom to freedom protest. You got the right to gather, and but
so it is contained in the Constitution.
It is contained in
and
the Constitution.
And it's contained in the Gatherings Act.
Yes.
Okay.
But the court actually indicated that this particular section conflicted with the right to freedom of peaceful assembly, and because it criminalizes people who are simply exercising their constitutional right. So what I'm saying is that it was therefore very difficult to bring a charge in terms of the Gatherings Act. Because the court just the day before actually explained what is a gathering, what is peaceful, what does it mean in terms of this particular provision. So that is why I believe the charges were brought in terms of road.
Yeah, but I mean, there was no alternative, obviously.
No, there was no alternative, but I mean, and the only other was that
to beat people up, to throw people on the floor, to drag people across the tarmac, and they end up being charged with a road traffic offense and in the breach of interdict. Surely there's a kind of a conflict there between the action taken and the charges laid. I think, that's something that the community must look at critically, you know. I mean, and of course the lawyers that represent these communities. Nasha, what consequences will there be for these particular gentlemen, and I don't know if there was ladies, pertaining to, I mean, these guys that Anwar said earlier on, they use a nice word, ultra vires, acting outside the scope and authority of your power. What action can one take against these errant peace officers?
Well, there's a range. You can lay criminal charges, obviously, which I think IPED should investigate them.
IPED?
Yes, which is
Internal Police Investigative Directorate.
Yeah. I mean, Nazir is the perfect dictionary. Yes. The interpreter.
Thank you, Nazir. Okay. We just call it IPED and SAPS.
We'll have to just break quickly for an ad, and when we come back, we're gonna conclude your segment, and then, of course, me and Nazir, we're going to continue talking about some of the actions that can be taken against these errant so-called peace officers.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
And we are back with the Legal Hour, and for the last half an hour, Shyam, I know that you're going to be leaving us shortly. Shyam, you just want to make your concluding remark, and thanks for giving us, like, you know, a little bit of a background on why we found our community in conflict with the police, and your final comment on it.
Yes, Ihsan, I think the question that we have is this, that why didn't, for example, the police also possibly oppose this application? Okay, because if it was this wide,
the police are already struggling with resources. Do you think?
Well, this is going to be worse, because the problem that you're sitting with is that there is potential civil claims against SAPS as well as Metro as well as traffic. In addition to that, these criminal charges can also be brought, and this is the reality. And I'm going back to the Donan article, where it actually questions whether or not police resources should be used in this manner. Because maybe something else should have been there, some other form of remedy, some other form of creative remedy, to be able to ensure that what happened on Tuesday not should happen, or it shouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. Because maybe if the police oppose the applicant, you say, we can't use this particular resource. Yeah. So something else had to happen.
Just to bring in another incident. In the Northwest, there was the whole issue of marijuana. I mean, all remember the whole one-man thing. Now, how did the police, how did the state deal with it, that type of event will not happen again?
But that's an inquiry that was done. But at the end of the day, what we must look at, there are a few other cases, and it's got to do with reasonable force. It's got to do with whether or not the actions of the police was disproportionate in relation to the actions of the community. Now, honestly, if you have like 20 old women, one which was there's like a few that was over 60, and then you even have a 90-year-old that was sitting there, was this disproportionate? And that's the question that we need to ask. Because was there some other form of solution that could have been found? Other than doing what they did, it was unacceptable.
Shyam, how do we go about getting a commission of inquiry going on this one? I mean, surely it justifies it. I mean, it was all over the news. People are angry. People are hurt. People have been traumatized, brutalized. Now, how do we, in fact, Nazir, maybe you want to answer that? How do we get to a point where we request the state to appoint a commission of inquiry to look into this matter and just as to why was it that the police acted in such a manner or felt fit to act in such a manner? And who were the paymasters in this regard? Shyam, I will excuse you. I know that you've got to run off to another meeting, and shukran for attending tonight. Hopefully, I mean, this is not the end of the discussion. There's a whole lot of questions coming in, and I really apologize to my listeners for not reading it out yet, but hopefully we will have an opportunity to read some of these questions when we only have one guest left. So Shyam, you can just greet.
Yes, assalamu alaikum, and thank you, Irshan, again for having me. I have to, like you said, I have another community meeting which I have to attend.
Okay, and good luck with it. Shukran for coming. Assalamu alaikum. Nazir, the floor is now entirely yours. We've got now, you know, Anwar has left us, Shyam has left us, and now you're going to unfortunately have to bear the brunt of all these questions that came through. But maybe before we get there, let's talk about a commission of inquiry. Why should it be that we can have a commission of inquiry on all these things happening in South Africa at the moment? Like, you know, we had a commission of inquiry in respect of Marikana, where people were killed by through police action. We've had now the State Capture Commission. We've had a whole lot of things. I do believe that these types of actions, it's been on the news, it's been on SABC, it's been on ENCA, it's been on all the news channels. Surely it's of national importance.
I agree with you fully, Shan. I think the limitations that the people of Cape Town have in this thing is not enough noise is being made about it. And I think the moment where there will be a lot of political pressure on this particular issue, that is when mechanisms like commissions of inquiry will start taking place, and when all the developments leading up to and concluding the entire event that took place on Tuesday will be really put under the sword, where the people of Cape Town and the Bulkup community will really receive a lot of the answers to all the questions that are floating around, much of which we've discussed, but a lot of unasked questions is still out there regarding all of these things.
And Azir, we touched on it with Shyam earlier on. That, you know, my contention, you know, as an observer, is that we've had a situation where the police acted in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Now, the normal reaction of lawyers and of people saying that we want action against the police, and then they end up suing the Minister of Police, the poor Minister of Police, who's probably in Pretoria somewhere, blissfully unaware of what's happening within the ranks of the rank and file of the police. Isn't it time that we start suing these errant police officers in their personal capacity?
Irshan, that is an option to do that even as we speak. It's an option to basically take them to task individually, as you say. The problem is that 9 times out of 10, when it comes to civil suits, people will not be able to get the recourse out of an individual per se because of the limitation of that specific individual to maybe, let's say, fulfill a civil claim in his or her ability with respect.
So in other words, there would be a person of straw. Correct. In other words, there's no point in suing that person.
That's correct.
But surely, I mean, look, a judgment is there for 30 years. I mean, you can lay claim to that person's pension when he retires.
I agree with you.
So there's obviously, you know, more creative ways to sue these people in their individual capacity simply because they and simply that they acted outside the course and scope of their duty in violating a community.
I agree with you, but at the same time I have to say maybe the fact that the minister is himself at the risk in terms of any civil suits, it will give him a lot more call it power to try and keep his stock under control, if you want to put it that way, to keep the police intact, to ensure that they don't go outside the scope of their powers. Because the moment that you expose the individual, the minister might, I'm not saying he will, but might take a step back or take his foot off the pedal. But that being said, I do agree with you that the fact that you're going to target the individual will give that individual a lot more time to think about his actions.
Look, I don't, well, from my understanding is I can't think of a precedent where it has been done before. Mm. I mean, everybody just jumps to the minister and say, now, well, the minister was responsible, or the commissioner of police, they were responsible. But those orders never came from those structures. Mm. Surely, if somebody clubs an 80-year-old woman over the head with his baton, or he throws a stun grenade next to a 5-year-old, injuring that 5-year-old's hearing for life, surely that individual that caused that action, committed that action, should actually be held accountable.
Oh, the task. I think that is possibly where the criminal element of all of this will come about, Ihsan. Maybe the civil suit is not the best alternative. Maybe the criminals... setup or justice system is there.
Yeah, but under what would you charge that particular police person?
Excessive force. He's gone outside in the scope and the need, as Sham pointed out. There's no reasonable. What is the reasonable force required to deal with the situation? He has clearly gone outside the reasonability of what was needed.
And but what is the common law charge? I mean, surely, I mean, you can charge him in terms of are you saying we must charge him in terms of an act of that? Section 49 of the criminal.
Assault, GBH,
something like that. Yes, yeah. There we can go.
We can definitely consider criminal charges along those lines.
You know, Nazir, and I mean, I'm sorry to harp on this thing, but I want to get some clarity. And I want to get, the collective ears listening to this now, you know, obviously saw this particular actions happening in Bonteville, where that poor lady was actually dragged to a cell and it was slammed practically in the face. You know, it was brutal. It reminded one of the apartheid regime where people just didn't care. And worst of all, it was actually male police personnel that were actually manhandling female protesters. Mm. Surely that in itself is a problem.
It is. As I understand the policies of SAPS, where there's female perpetrators involved, there must be a police official of the same gender dealing with the matter. You can't have a male police officer handling a female in scenarios like that.
Okay, so Nazir, I'm back on this issue of you saying it could potentially be a criminal matter. So let's assume for a moment that you are correct as a lawyer. And you now have a criminal matter, and now the guy stands in there. He's charged under assault GBH. And then, of course, he gets a suspended sentence, or he gets a fine of 500 rand for acting out something that he can live with, you know, in the short term. But if one goes the civil route, surely that's going to affect him long term.
Correct.
Because now that is going to affect him for 30 years. Because if he doesn't have money today, you wait that out. You wait until the day that pension gets paid out. Mm. And you attach that pension with your judgment. Mm. Surely that is a more effective way to do it.
Ihsan, the fact of the matter is, like you're saying, a civil judgment remains enforceable for a period of 30 years. And if that judgment hasn't been executed against, and there is a means to execute after 10 years of the judgment being granted, that warrant will still be issued, and the sheriff of the court will be perfectly empowered and entitled to go and enforce that judgment.
So hopefully, inshallah, the community that's being affected, or the communities affected by these acts of brutality by the very forces, the very security forces that are supposed to protect innocent people, I hope they are listening to this and they are taking cognizance of particular actions that they can take, be it civil or criminal. I'm going to jump to some of the questions that are being asked here by the listeners, and some is getting very irate at me for actually not reading the comments, and I will do so right after the break.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
And we are back with the Legal Hour. Unfortunately, we are only left with one guest. We started off with three guests. We had Anwar Nagyaya, we had Shyam Samaya, and we're now with Nazir Parker. And that is, unfortunately, the limitation of having very, very busy community activists, you know, as guests, you know, that they need to run. They can't give you 2 hours. They can give you only 1 hour or 30 minutes. And that's okay, because we need those inputs, you know, as much as we can. And, of course, very valuable advice to the community. So, Nazir, coming back to one of these questions, there's quite a few. Let me read the first one. It says, how come when the state are being challenged by taxpaying citizens in court, the state uses taxpayers' money to pay lawyers, but the taxpayers have to fork up their own money? It's a grave injustice. Example, High Court D6 Working Committee versus the state. And this person is asking this question, and I think it's a very, very valid question, and it's a question that's very, very close to my heart. And Nazir, I'm unfortunately going to interrogate you on this issue now, because I think it, in fact, to my mind, it is a grave injustice that state departments are utilizing state resources to pay very expensive commercial lawyers who end up dragging these matters instead of trying to resolve those matters with the community. Mm. Your comment, please.
Ikshan, firstly, the listener is hitting the nail right on the head. Yes, we have to acknowledge that the state in running a particular country has to resource and allocate its money where it where it's needed. But then again, your comment is going over and above that. The fact of the matter is, and we're having this discussions as to why there was not this initial mediation process with between the developers and the community to try and circumvent the need for the people to run to court and run up the cost of legal fees and, in fact, waste judicial court time, which can be used in other matters. And it is unfortunately a position where whoever is representing the state in these type of things might not be advising them adequately or appropriately, for the simple reason that there might be an interest there for them. And in my opinion, that's a conflicted interest, because you cannot advise correctly if you have something to gain at the end of it.
And they gain legal fees.
Again, we're talking enormous amount of legal
fees.
Yeah,
but Nazir, but surely, you know, if the community can lodge a potential complaint against that particular government department and accuse them, rightfully so, of conducting themselves in a wasteful and fruitless expenditure scenario. I mean, surely that can be achieved.
It can. These are reasons why you have qualified audits. Once the noise is made, then the auditors step in and determine whether these expenditures have been necessary or whether it was in fact a wasteful exercise. And once that is determined, heads will roll inevitably, and to avoid this from happening again.
I think, Nazir, and I mean maybe for the community as well, is to take notice of this particular comment, and I wanted to comment on it, Nazir, is that surely, you know, the state is setting up all forms of entities, commissions, public protector, you name it, you know, they've got all of these institutions in place, but isn't it time for government to step in and create a panel of lawyers, maybe that came from the private sector, to have a look at all the these fruitless expenditure by government departments paying private lawyers a whole lot of money for exercises in futility against communities.
No, it is, Ikshan. The fact of the matter is the attorneys are the ones that are appropriately geared to deal with these things, because they are fully, and even if they come out of the private sector, they are fully equipped and knowledgeable about issues like these. And practitioners like us in the private sector, the first thing we look at when we get a matter coming across our desk is, can we resolve this now? And the simple question is, why can that not apply across the table in matters like these, where there's government institutes involved in the dispute? And simply, if there is an attorney panel dealing with assessing these things, I'm sure that the state will end up saving a lot more resources in respect of finance that can be used gravely elsewhere.
Okay, here's another question that I want to read out, and we'll interrogate this question as well. It says here, the police were ruthless and brutal. They must be charged under the acts that protect communities, the right to protest peacefully. Mm. Why not use the recent judgment passed by the High Court for people to protest peacefully? It wasn't the High Court, it was the Constitutional Court, from my understanding. There's a clear breach in terms of this judgment. And then they ask, who gave the command to the Metro Police and, of course, the National Police to use such force? I think that's the question. I don't expect you to answer the whole question. Mm. I think maybe we must just maybe look at what's the remedy pertaining to this in terms of these. It doesn't matter who gave the command, but at the end of the day, we need to, I mean, as we said earlier on, I asked you the question, how does one go about setting up a commission of inquiry? Mm. And I think you answered it. Mm. And I think maybe that particular action must be taken by the communities, hopefully the unified community of Bukap, to actually call upon the proper authority to actually set up a commission of inquiry. Then, of course, some of these questions can be answered.
Mm. Now, I agree. Ikshan, the fact is, with regards to the judgment that has now come out dealing with the Gatherings Act, and the Constitutional Court, as Sean pointed out, succinctly dealt with a lot of the issues around the right to protest, the right to gather, the right to have voices heard. And the fact is that if the Constitutional Court is recognizing the fact that the legislation enacted by national government and or local government is incorrect, then surely the custodians who are supposed to uphold the law, such as the police, metro, law enforcement, traffic, should take cognizance of these groundbreaking judgments by the Constitutional Court. Why is there this inherent need for them, as police officers who is supposed to protect the community, why is there this need for them to try and impose themselves forcefully on the community? That is the question which I don't believe that has been asked and answered correctly by the people or the powers that be. At this point in time, if one narrows it down to the Tuesday event that happened in the Bukap, everything there was unnecessary. There was no need for the force and the exertion of violence there. Because like Shyam said, I mean, you're dealing with people who are not geared for violence.
Mm. Yeah, I think, Nazir, a lot of people would obviously call this state-sanctioned violence. Mm. But I question, as a social commentator, was it state-sanctioned? Is it not just a question of an overzealous police captain, a metro officer who felt that, you know what, I don't like the attitude of this particular of these protesters. So that is why I am saying maybe the suggestion is a commission of inquiry, and failing that the community must launch on these individual police or metro officers a civil suit so that they can feel the brunt of a civil action. And of course, as you said, a potential criminal action, but I don't have, there's no credible information available that I can say that, you know, that there will be a successful prosecution of these police officers. Mm. So yes, so that's maybe my conclusion of this particular program. And So do you agree with that whole concept, or is it something that's up there in the air?
No, I agree, Sean. I think the individual prosecutions, civil suits and the like will definitely drive home the message that you are not above what you are supposed to be protecting.
Yeah. Nazir, here's another question that came in. This listener is really harassing me to ask this question on air, and I will. It says, hi, Mr. Higgins. If there were people responsible for concluding agreements with the block development company, will we as the listeners be privileged to know what they agreed to, and will we be informed who they are? We need to know who to trust and have a future relationship with. Why is the Bukap councillor and the city of Cape Town also not part of this discussion? Salam. I don't think, Nazir, you should be answering this question. I think these are the questions that needs to be ventilated in some form of alternative dispute resolution mechanism, like a mediation. And I'm hoping that the Pukap community and others that are assisting that community will find each other and understand who the collective enemy of the people can be or will be in future. And I think they must basically unite. What do you think? Is it possible?
Very possible, Yashan. The old saying comes to mind, united we stand and divided we fall. And I think that's been the cards that's been played here. If what I'm reading is correct, some members of the Pukap community is taking time to get onto the joint bandwagon, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, and then the last question I want to ask, I know the technician gave me the look. We almost need to break now. It says, how come all these things are happening but the government department are still getting clean audits? That, unfortunately, is a question for another day. We will be looking at those things. And yes, maybe we should get the city officials. Maybe we need to get the person in charge of the Metro Police on, and maybe he can say, well, it has never been intended to be ultra vires, or it wasn't against the community, they were just doing the job. We would like to hear from them. Hopefully we can get those people on air, maybe in the legal hour. Nazir, you can wrap up now, and unfortunately our time has now lapsed, and Muta Yusuf will be coming into the studio soon.
Ishan, just from my perspective, I think this is a topic which you can't really deal with in 2 hours. I think, like Shyam and Anwar and yourself have been hinting towards, I think there needs to be a lot more dealt with in this matter through a commission of inquiry, with any other mediatory process where the community can be heard, as well as whatever views the developers may have, the state can comment on it, and like you said, the heads of local municipal departments can all provide comments, so that everybody can establish a joint solution that's suitable for all in this whole thing.
Okay, from my side, and shukran Nazir very much for concluding this program. From my side, Ihsan Higgins, I just want to say I want to thank the community for listening to us this evening, and hopefully we were of service, and of it cleared up a whole lot of issues in people's minds in respect of this onslaught against the community, or rather various communities throughout the Western Cape, throughout South Africa. So for those people that have sent us, you know, normal civil questions and criminal questions, you know, I'm sorry we didn't read your questions tonight, but you are welcome to contact the Legal Cafe on 082-336-3778. And I repeat the number, 082-336-3778. And hopefully we can answer your question via WhatsApp. If not, we will invite you to come to the Legal Cafe, and we will hopefully be able to assist you there. So from my side, and from Nazir the Parker side, you know, in studio, we say assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.